We'll hear arguments next in number 1427, McDaniel against Patty.
How long did that take, Chief?
That's 7 minutes. Shortest since my time. Wondering what I said.
Yeah. 7 minutes.
Very wise on both sides.
But it was. Mr. LeClaire, I think you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The appellant in this case is Paul McDaniel, a minister from Chattanooga, Tennessee. He declared as a candidate and properly filed as a candidate for a delegate to the 1977 Tennessee Constitutional Convention, at which time he was sued by one of his opponents to have his name stricken from the ballot because he was a minister of the gospel, and a provision of the present Tennessee Constitution, Article 9, provides that no priest or minister of the gospel may serve in legislative office in Tennessee. And the call to the Tennessee Constitutional Convention of 1977 picked up that qualification for persons who were to serve as delegates to the Constitutional Convention. The matter was heard in the Chancery Court in Hamilton County, and the Chancellor enjoined the requirement as being in violation of the free exercise of religion. An appeal was taken to the Tennessee Supreme Court, which remanded for not having given notice to the Attorney General. The case was then heard in the Chancery Court of Hamilton County with the Attorney General appearing, and the Chancellor again enjoined the provision on Establishment Clause grounds. During the period when an appeal was taken to the Tennessee Supreme Court by the state and Ms. Patey, the election was held, and Reverend McDaniel won handily. He came within a few votes of having more than the other three candidates combined. The Tennessee Supreme Court heard this case and decided that Reverend McDaniel could not serve because of the provision of the Tennessee Constitution, and upheld the exclusion on separation grounds. Counsel then sought a stay from Mr. Justice Stewart, which was denied with the suggestion that application be made to the Tennessee Supreme Court, which was then done, and the Tennessee Supreme Court granted a stay until June 20, 1977, at which time the Tennessee Supreme Court denied a second request for a stay, and Mr. Justice Stewart then granted appellant's request for a stay. The Constitutional Convention began August 1, 1977, and Reverend McDaniel has been sitting as a delegate to that convention under the stay granted by Mr.
Is it still in session, the Constitution?
The Constitutional Convention is still in session.
Any anticipation or anything you can tell from the record about when they expect it to end?
It's very difficult to predict when legislative groups in Tennessee will end.
Or anywhere else.
But what would happen, counsel, if upon election or upon filing as a candidate, which we can now under the Tennessee law, the ordained minister renounced his ordination and resigned? Would that clear him of the disability, or don't we know?
Is there query, Mr. Chief Justice?
He might be tainted for life.
You know, that issue, that we face that issue in the brief on the vagueness question. And this was a very much question in England. Can one renounce his ministry? Can one be defrocked and then run for office? It's by no means clear on the face of the Tennessee disqualifying provision. Whether that could be done. Now, this case, the issues in this case, involve several provisions of the Constitution. This is a voting rights case. It involves a right to be a candidate for a public office, which this court has vindicated in the past. It involves voting rights as well, since the right to vote for priests or ministers of the gospel is an important right. We face the same question in this case that was faced by the court some years back when it addressed the question of whether persons in the military could be fenced out from candidacy or from exercise of their voting rights.
In what cases have we vindicated what you described, the right to be a candidate?
It's my opinion, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that this was done in Bullock, and in Lubin v. Panish and an American party of Texas v. White. It seems to me that one can say that the rights of candidates qua candidates were vindicated in these cases, although I don't think it makes a great deal of difference even if the court should choose to vindicate these rights as voting rights. We also have at stake here free exercise rights. Because Reverend McDaniel has chosen to exercise his rights as a minister of the gospel, he has been penalized in his voting rights. So you have a situation where the appellant is put in the to the Hobson's choice of either choosing between his voting rights, which this court has declared are fundamental, or his free exercise rights, which this court has declared are fundamental.
Is voting rights being his right to vote for himself?
Yes, yes, or for any other minister, since this has been certified as a class action by the Chancellor of the Hamilton County Court.
They both may be fundamental, but only one is a constitutionally protected right, isn't that correct? You read the case of Minor against Happerstadt. You'll find it stated there by the court unanimously, as I remember, that there's no constitutional right to vote.
Well, we look
it's that case that made necessary the amendment of our Constitution to allow women to vote. That was an equal protection case. The court said the Equal Protection Clause gave no such right.
We look upon the...
Whereas the First Amendment protects and creates freedoms and rights, doesn't it?
Yes. But we think the voting rights cases of this court are sufficient to as well to seek the appellate.
Who was in this class?
All ministers who shall be candidates for office of delegate to the constitutional to this or future constitutional conventions. And all candidates for legislative office.
Well, how can that be a class? I thought a class was a large number of people.
Well, we think there may be a number of other ministers who...
Name one.
Well, Mr. Justice Marshall, it's my understanding that there are several other ministers who are serving at this time as delegates to the Tennessee Constitutional Convention.
Is that in this case? Is that in place in this case I put my hand on?
We did not know at the time that this class was certified.
I thought a class situation. Had to be a number that was too many to name. I'm not using exact language, but I think that is what the language is.
Well, in the federal law, this is state.
The state class action requirement is patterned upon Rule 23.
Why doesn't the class include every ordained minister in the state of Tennessee? Whether or not he has a present intention of running for anything.
Well, that's a point well taken, Your Honor.
It's an inhibition. The Supreme Court is an inhibition now resting on every ordained minister in the state. Is it not?
I think that the... That really wouldn't matter very much, however, because if the class relief were afforded, as appellant sought, any minister whoever wanted to seek legislative office in Tennessee would be allowed to do so.
Well, is it very important to us now for our purposes, whether it is a proper class action or whether it's only one man?
I think it is important for this reason. If we strike down Chapter 848 of the Tennessee Public Acts of 1976, dealing with the call to this convention, then we only deal with this particular call. And it means that next year, should some minister in Tennessee choose to be a candidate for legislative office, that he could be excluded under this provision. And it would entail the great expense that has been entailed in this or any other case that comes to this court to afford relief. And we may not have the fortuitous event then which occurred here.
Well, this court always, if we disagree with the judgment of the Supreme Court of Tennessee, our mandate is always vacated and reversed for further proceedings not inconsistent with this opinion. We would not tell, as I understand our practice, the Supreme Court of Tennessee what form of mandate to send down to the Chancery Court in Hamilton County, so long as it was not inconsistent with our opinion.
Well, the only problem that I could see coming from that is that the Supreme Court of Tennessee limited the cross appeal taken by appellant from the Chancellor's ruling to this particular case and this particular statute. And they relied on, I believe, the Story case in Tennessee, which in our brief counsel has alleged is inapposite. It is simply a question of whether this court is willing to resolve this question in Tennessee.
You'd have a precedent in any event if we simply decided it on the narrowest of grounds.
That's quite true, sir, but it's also true that chancellors and circuit judges at the local level in Tennessee may view precedents in very different lights. And if this court granted relief only as to the call for the 1977 convention, it's possible that some local judge may try to distinguish that away and deny relief to some ministerial candidate for a legislative office. Then the election would be held, and ultimately, even though the state appellate court may choose to grant relief, it would be faced with a very disruptive possibility of having to invalidate an election, call an election again.
Well, you'd have all the same remedies that were available to you in this case, wouldn't you?
You know, we're very lucky that we had a good chancellor at the local level who afforded relief and allowed our candidate to run.
I'm speaking of the stay processes.
Had a good circuit justice.
Very fine.
Well, is the chancellor still there? The circuit justice is still here.
Yeah, but we don't have him in every county in Tennessee, Mr. Justice Marshall.
Well, if you want us to draw a decree that will stop every judicial officer in the state of Tennessee from doing wrong, forget about it.
We don't expect that. But we do think that we are entitled to a decree that would prevent the state of Tennessee from ever disqualifying for candidacy for a public office any person because of his being a priest or a minister of the gospel.
Mr. LeClaire, could I ask a question about your theory on the merits? Supposing Tennessee had a law that said they decided they want to have a fresh look at the whole governmental structure, and they'd like to exclude from those participating in the Constitutional Convention anyone presently serving in the state legislature or in the state executive department. So they just excluded all senior government officials. Would that be permissible?
In my opinion, it certainly would.
Well, why wouldn't they be forced to make the same kind of Hobson's choice between serving in the legislature or serving in the Constitutional Convention?
Because that's a matter of choosing between two secular offices. And the state can decide that a man ought to spend all of his time on one secular office and not split his responsibilities. But the state under the First Amendment, under the Establishment Clause and under the Free Exercise Clause, state has no business interfering in what a person does, one way or the other.
What if their theory is that, well, these people now in public office are unduly influential in the deliberations of the new body, and they might think ministers are unduly persuasive, they can use certain kinds of arguments that some of the rest of us can't use, and so we better keep them out of these debates?
As to the influence of ministers, I don't think that it would be permissible to exclude presidents of corporations, and many of them exert substantial influence, presidents of universities, many of them exert substantial influence, and I would say that it would certainly deny ministers as a class equal protection. To treat them differently from other persons who have equal or greater amounts of influence.
But to exclude all college presidents would violate what section of the Constitution?
I think it would violate the Equal Protection Clause, but because it would be treating people who are similarly situated differently.
Suppose it excluded all lawyers.
Well, you know, we have a reference to that in the brief, and that parliament was called the lack-learning parliament. I think that a case could be made for excluding lawyers, which could not be made for excluding ministers. I'd hate to see that done.
But, why?
Because it would be singling out an occupational class for invidious treatment without any reference to the capacity of that group to serve. Many of the lawyers who serve in legislatures serve very honorably and with distinction, and in 49 other states in the Union, ministers are permitted to serve in the legislature, and it's only because of an anachronism that goes back to the Tennessee Constitution of 1796.
Do you know of anybody who could be excluded?
Well, I answered Mr. Justice Stevens' question. I think the state could certainly exclude justices of its court from serving in the legislature or any officer in government. There's no problem with the validity of the Hatch Act or similar state laws.
Well, what about all ministers?
Well, I think that
There are chaplains in every penitentiary in North Carolina, are there not?
Well, but whereas a minister...
Are there?
I don't know.
Well,
ministers...
Assuming that there are chaplains in the state penitentiaries, on the payroll of the state, could they be excluded?
I think the state might exclude any state officer because...
Even if he happens to be a minister?
I would say even if he happens to be a minister.
And on your theory, he wouldn't be singled out as a minister, but as a state employee.
As a state employee, yes, that would be a rational classification. But this classification is not rational, and it singles out persons for invidious treatment because of their...
Is this 14th or First Amendment, Your
Honor? I think it's both, sir.
It's both.
And we submit this as a... The free exercise and establishment clauses have been incorporated or absorbed by the 14th. And in that sense, it is both a First and 14th Amendment case. Yes, it is an equal protection case in that we are contending that the state has denied the voting rights and rights of political candidacy to ministers. And I cited... earlier, the cases on which we rely on voting. I also think it's a due process case on vagueness grounds. Who is there to determine who is a minister or a priest within the meaning of this Tennessee statute?
Well, ultimately, I suppose your state Supreme Court might be called upon to do it.
It's a very difficult task, and it invites the very type of entanglement problems that this court has tried to avoid. Determining who is a minister.
How many denominations make all of their members, their adherents, ministers of that church? There are several, I believe.
Yes, there are.
I recall whether your brief numbered all of them or not. Undertook to.
No, I'm sure that our list was not exhaustive, but it was suggestive of a number of denominations which The Mormons, for example, require that each member of the faith engage in a ministry of several years when they perform religious functions. A number of fundamentalist religions hire working preachers who are involved in the community in their own job. They support themselves with a regular job, but they preach on Sunday. Would such a person be disqualified under the Tennessee Act? We think that the vagueness problems on due process grounds with this statute are very substantial.
Of course, there's no vagueness as to your client, Mr. Leclerc.
No vagueness, absolutely not.
With respect to the 1641 legislation in England, your very interesting brief described the historical conditions then and how important the clergy was in England at that time. If we thought that the clergy was equally important in Tennessee when this statute was passed, would you say the statute was unrational?
There is a vital distinction between the situation in England in 1641 and the situation in Tennessee in 1796, in that the church was established in England. And the danger in England was that the commons, which controlled the appropriation of funds, if dominated by Anglican priests, would vote the state church great sums of money. Since we have no established church in Tennessee, and never have had an established church, I think the argument would be an apposite. But that 1641 Act, with friends like that, the church needs few enemies. A couple other points. Constitution, the body of the Constitution itself, right in the same section with the Supremacy Clause, provides that there shall be no religious test for office. Now, there is some question as to whether that applies to state offices or whether it applies only to federal offices. But it seems to me, coming where it does in the Constitution, with the Supremacy Clause, that clause of the Constitution also affords a basis for overturning this Constitution, this requirement. Now, of course, the support in the decisions of this Court are not as great for that argument as it is for the arguments that I have been discussing. But I do think that that is a respectable argument. It has been made. I believe Mr. Justice Black, a number of years back, used this as either a basis of a concurring or a dissenting opinion, and I think a respectable argument can be made looking back to Farron's records of the Federal Convention. And even if the Court were to decide clause did not apply in full force at the time it was adopted, it would be permissible for that guarantee as being a fundamental guarantee to be received through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment.
May I ask one other historical question, Mr. Leclerc?
Yes, sir.
Your brief pointed out that Thomas Jefferson once might have disagreed with your argument here, and then he later changed his mind.
Is a credit. And a strength.
But do you suppose any provision that could have commended itself to Thomas Jefferson even for a few years and even temporarily could be so irrational that we ought to strike it down?
Thomas, this view commended itself to Thomas Jefferson only at a time prior to the enactment of the First Amendment, and I think that explains Mr. Jefferson's position. I think historically, one can justify these clauses in the state constitutions of 1776, because at that time the church in this country had not been disestablished. And as Your Honor knows, the church was not disestablished, I think, in Massachusetts until 1830 or 1831. So there was a very great fear of an established church. But the First Amendment, with its establishment clause, put those fears to rest. And it's interesting that this Tennessee provision was 1796. This is only 4 years after the First Amendment, or 5 years. This Tennessee provision is really contemporaneous with the First Amendment, and it policy-wise, it looks back to a time before the First Amendment. Now, whether or not the framers of this amendment were anti-clerical, there were some anti-clerical forces in Tennessee at that time, or whether they were trying to give a preference for religion. In either case, the clause would fall on Establishment Clause grounds. Your Honor, if I may, if there are no further questions, I'd like to save the remaining time for rebuttal.
Very well. Mr. Harrell.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Under the Constitution that we live under in this country, we have certain fundamental rights which are guaranteed to us by the Constitution and the amendments. These are fundamental, so fundamental that they cannot be taken away from us. However, we also have other rights that we enjoy in this country that can be, we submit, limited because they are not absolutely guaranteed by our Constitution. The case that we have for consideration here today involves these two questions, these two principles which I want to explore. These cover all the issues, I believe, that have been made in this case. The issue of free exercise of religion, the Establishment Clause, the Equal Protection Clause, and the Due Process Clause.
They are all express provisions of the Constitution,
right.
Are they not?
Yes, sir. But as my purpose here that I want to attempt to distinguish these cases that have been decided by this Court citing certain applications of a person's right. In the first category, we have cases where they're absolute. That is, the right pertaining to a belief. This cannot be changed by our concept of a Constitution. This Court would not do so. However, there are certain practices which can be limited, I think, by the application of activities of a person who wants to enjoy his rights under a Constitution. For instance, this Court has said in the Tocasso case, a case undertaken to interpret the question of a right of belief, this Court said properly that that could not be compelled. Likewise, the case has said that where you have a question involving sanctions, as was indicated in the Shemp case, that cannot be condoned. Now, as this Court has said in Cantrell, the free act that we have to act is not absolute. It comes in this latter category and can be subject to certain limitations where there are proper basis for it. For instance, in the Sherbert case, this Court said that where there's an indirect burden may inhibit the free exercise right where there's a compelling state interest. In the Braunfels case, the Court has said that the state may limit a person's practice, even though it may cause some inconvenience to him. And in the Walsh case, a valid secular objective is an appropriate subject of legislation. I submit that that is what we have for consideration before us at this time. Now, as to the Establishment Clause, I don't think it need be said that there's any question. But what the purpose of this clause is to keep the state from establishing any form of religion, any requirement for a particular religion. It's admitted that there has been no establishment created by the virtue of the act that's in question here. And again, under Shemp, a secular purpose is a valid basis for a legislative purpose.
What is the valid secular objective here?
That is the separation of church and state that I want to get into.
And that's the only one?
Yes, sir.
Well, then this brings us to a tension or potential conflict between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, does it?
That is correct. And that is the point that I want to explore now on tests that this Court has used in interpreting this kind of cases of this kind.
Mr. Attorney General, when was this provision first enacted?
It was enacted in the original Constitution of Tennessee in 1796, was a carryover basically from the Constitution of North Carolina.
Has it been reconsidered?
No, sir.
Has it ever been litigated?
No, sir.
Don't you think it's time?
Well, it's before the Court now. There are three tests that this Court can consider or has been recognized previously as a basis for a test to consider the application of this test. The rational basis test, that is the minimum test. And to the other extreme, there's a compelling state interest test, which is a maximum. What I want to get into now and submit to the Court that the proper test for this Court, as laid down in Bullock, is the strict scrutiny test. What basis does the state have? Is it sufficient? The state submits that it is a sufficient basis. Under this principle and test, the system must be closely scrutinized and found to be reasonably necessary for the carrying out of a legitimate state purpose. It's submitted that this is a legitimate state purpose, that is, the separation of church and state. It's recognized, likewise, that the state cannot be arbitrary in attempting to accomplish its goals. But it's submitted there is no arbitrary action in this case, and the criterion for a different treatment must bear some relevance to the object being the separation of church and state, which is at issue here.
Do you happen to know whether we have had any president except one who was an ordained minister?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
President Wilson was a Presbyterian minister, of course. No other?
Since you recall that to my attention, I believe it was, yes. I'm not aware of any other, though. Now then, we'll move on to other questions that have been raised in this case. That is a question of equal protection. As this Court has said in Walker, there is no fundamental right or suspect case to consider in this case. All ministers are treated in a like and similar manner. What applies to one will apply to all. As our Court said in the case, that it covers priests of all denominations and their counterparts in other religions.
I thought your opponent was complaining not so much about distinctions between priests and ministers as the distinction between the clergy and the rest of the population.
But if we consider the state's basis, we think that there is a sufficient basis to put them in a category to themselves, that is, for the separation of church and state. I'd like to suggest to the Court, too, what it has found, that there is no fundamental right to hold office.
General, supposing the state said nobody who goes to church every week shall serve in the state legislature. Regular churchgoers are too religious and men have complete separation.
I think that would violate one of their religious tenets, where they had a right to worship, part of their fundamental belief.
Well, then nothing would prevent them from continuing to go to church. They just couldn't be in the state legislature, that's all.
Well, I think that would be in the similar category that we have before us here.
You say that would be equally valid or invalid,
yes,
just like this statute?
Yes, sir. This Court has likewise said in Turner that there is no fundamental right.
We're not going so far as to approve a statute and say that everybody believes in God, you kept out, would you?
No, sir. That involves their fundamental belief.
But you could, I understand you to say you could say that as long as you serve in the legislature, you may not go to church more than once a month?
Well, in the first place.
It sounds to me like what you said. At least you may not go to church every week.
Well, if you assume that premise, I think that would be true.
Well,
yes.
I know, but that's what I thought. Is that what you answered, Mr. Justice Stevens?
Yes, sir, it is.
Mm-hmm.
This court, too, has recently said in the Williams case that there is no basis for a claim of fundamental, that is, a political right for association. No discrimination against a group. Now, in connection with that, I'd like to point out for the benefit of the court the fact that this case was not brought as a class action to the attention of this court. There's no assignment made on that. The Tennessee Supreme Court said that there was not a class action involved in this. Now, this court has had before it considerations in other cases questions of whether religious organizations are all members of the organization entitled to the exemption. Again, I want to call attention to the fact that our court has said that the ministers cover all beliefs, that is, those who would lead their people, teach them, whether it be of the Christian religion or of any other religion. So from this, I don't believe it can be said that you have a question of vagueness as to who is a minister. This court, under the Selective Service Acts, has had questions about ministers. I do not need to call that to your attention, such a case involving Dickinson. And as a group, ministers have been given special attention or special privileges, namely under the Selective Service Act, for instance. They are exempt from service under the Selective Service Acts.
And I assume they can also give the opening prayer at all of these meetings you're talking about from which they're excluded.
Yes, sir. And likewise, we have certain benefits for members of the clergy, such as benefits from our federal income tax provisions, not including all of their income. Now, the question has been raised here as to whether there are ministers in the Tennessee General Assembly. All of the prisons in the, whether ministers in the prisons in the state, all prisons in the state of Tennessee have ministers to serve to the needs of the inmates. In fact, I think they have several.
Well, are they paid by the state, provided by the state?
Is yes, sir.
You're telling us?
Yes, sir.
There are some states where they permit ministers from the outside, but not necessarily making them employees of the state. I wanted to be sure that which Tennessee had.
So by way of summary and conclusion here, I want to state again that there is no attempt made to regulate or control the belief of anyone in the Tennessee relative to what they can believe, so as to exclude them from the membership as a minister.
Mr. Attorney General, just before you finish, your opponent makes some places some emphasis on whether or not there was an established church in jurisdictions which had this sort of provision. Did Tennessee have an established church at the very beginning of its statehood?
To my knowledge, there has never been an established church in the state of Tennessee.
And how about this lost state of Franklin, which I guess is intermediate between North Carolina and Tennessee? Was that any established church in that state, as far as you know?
Not to my knowledge. No, the lost state of Franklin was an initial attempt to establish a state in the state of Tennessee, in the eastern part of it. That particular state, for one reason or another, gave up its charter and reverted back as a part of North Carolina. And then a later attempt was made to establish the state of Tennessee, which was then accepted.
Franklin went back into North Carolina. I thought it was part of eastern Tennessee.
No, sir.
I see. Thank you.
In your submission, I take it that those denominations which make all of the members ministers of that church would exclude all the members.
Yes, sir. We have to stand and say that ministers, if they are those as defined in the Tennessee case, which undertake to minister to the needs of their congregations. To that extent, they would be included.
Well, under the Tennessee definition, must there be an identifiable congregation in order to make its leader a minister?
I don't think so, as long as he would be in that category, where he would undertake to lead some of the people.
How could he get out from under being termed a minister under Tennessee law?
That could bring a very difficult decision to have to be made.
Difficult or impossible?
Well, I think you might even say impossible, to the extent that once a man is qualified as a minister and has those beliefs, that he could be said to continue those in his thoughts subconsciously.
And be excluded.
And be excluded, yes.
That if he says that I'm no longer a minister of the gospel, I'm an atheist, that wouldn't happen.
Well, if he professes to be an atheist and does not adhere to his religion, that might be a little different category.
Oh, he might make it if he becomes an atheist.
Yes, sir.
You can't put the tread back on a tire by running the car in reverse.
That's what I'm trying to say, yes, sir. Again, I want to summarize this very briefly to say that there is no attempt made to regulate the belief by this act. There's no attempt made to regulate the practice of religion by the act that's in question. And there is no denial of the appellant's rights under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And all ministers and their counterparts and all religions are excluded under the provisions of Article 9, Section 1 of the Tennessee Constitution. There is no fundamental right to hold public office. If the Court has no further questions, I submit it.
Very well. Do you have anything further, Mr. LeClaire?
Briefly. The separation of church and state argument, which has been made by the Attorney General of Tennessee, is a state doctrine, and it's our position that this runs afoul of the federal separation of church and state doctrine. The question of whether this case is brought as a class action to this court, appellant's position on that issue is that it was properly certified as a class action by the Chancellor, and that the authority on which the Tennessee court relied to deny the cross appeal of appellant was inapposite.
Federal question is raised by that.
It's a question of whether or not this issue must be addressed again in some other litigation after this case has been decided.
What federal right were you denied by the Supreme Court of Tennessee's ruling on that aspect of the case?
The rights of persons similarly situated to Reverend McDaniel to assert their federally protected rights to seek legislative office in the future.
Where do we find that enunciated in the Constitution or in the cases?
It would be in the voting rights. It would be in the same free exercise and establishment rights that are being asserted here. It's also a question of economics. It's a question of whether or not whether there is a likelihood of this court's decision leaving open the way for counsel to have to come back up and do this sort of thing again on candidacy for legislative office.
Are you against that or for that?
Oh, I'd be very much in favor of saving the money. Indeed, that speaking of money, this is a 1983 action for which, if appellant prevails, there is a right to attorney fees. Also, under the voting rights section of the Voting Rights Act of 1975, there is a provision for an award of attorney fees to prevailing counsel in voting rights litigation. So it would seem to me that it would even be in the interest of the state of Tennessee to have the thing decided once and for all, unless they want to pay counsel to do the same thing that has already been done. The matter of ministers having special privileges, being excluded from the service, The ready answer to that, which we provided in our brief, is that this is to encourage the free exercise rights of those who have been removed from their churches by being drafted or otherwise going into the army. The tax rights, similarly, this is to advance free exercise rights, the tax advantages which are afforded ministers. The difference between the tax advantages and the service provisions relating to ministers in law and this case is that here there is a penalty against ministers, and those cases involve preferences. So one other point. Although it is not commanded a majority view on this court, it is the case that the appellant is a black minister. And in the amended complaint, it was alleged that the effect of this provision is to disproportionately exclude a black leadership from candidacy for public office, because this court can take notice of the fact.
We don't have any Negro politicians in Tennessee.
Got a lot of them.
Not ministers.
Got a lot of them. But what we are saying is that the leadership in the black community traditionally has been overrepresented in the ministry, and even though this
you
court...
You are making statements that you can't back up, and I don't think you should make them, unless you've got facts to back them up. Would you agree?
I believe that the sociological...
You're talking about the leadership of Negroes in Tennessee. Now, cite me authority for that statement.
Your Honor, my time is up, but I would like to respond.
Yes, you may respond. I took your response to mean that of the professions, Negroes are proportionately have a higher representation in the clergy than in other professions.
In law or in medicine?
Yeah.
Black lawyers or black doctors could run for office. Black ministers can't. And since leadership...
And how many white ministers are in the Mormon Church? Yeah, because every member is one.
I think this case certainly transcends racial grounds, because it affects white ministers as well as blacks.
Well, does it really have anything to do with race at all? Suppose we had not known, as I did not, that this man was a Negro, white, or Chinese, or whatever. Would it make any difference to the fundamental issues that you're presenting here?
No, it's just an additional reason.
Well, then we needn't concern ourselves with it.
All right, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.